Good afternoon to everyone who is present here in Glasgow and to our online audience. If you can hear some noise in the background, this is the climate march passing through the streets of Glasgow, just outside of where we are here at the University of Strathclyde. Welcome to this session on climate legislation and its role in the implementation of the Paris Agreement. We have a fantastic panel with us today, which I will introduce in the order of speaking. But before we start, I just wanted to give you some context. Why are we discussing this subject and how does that link to the COP26 happening just around the corner from here and also to people marching on the streets today? Well, climate legislation has been growing in importance around the world. As of today, we have about 2,400 policies and laws around the world focusing on climate change, and about 890 legislative instruments as passed by national parliaments and national assemblies. And the importance of law is difficult to underestimate, as world leaders are putting forward their commitments and their pledges in Glasgow, in the Blue Zone. People on the streets are asking really for two things. They're asking A, for more ambition in terms of reducing emissions and putting financial commitments on the table to help developing countries to address climate change. But the second thing people on the streets of Glasgow and around the world are asking today is actually delivering on that ambition and making sure that those pledges actually materialize. And that's where the rule of law comes at the forefront. Policymakers tend to be focused on short-term concerns, on being re-elected into the office, and oftentimes they might forget the long-term ambition and the need to address climate change. And having climate objectives and also specific instruments to meet them worked into the law that is passed by Parliament and cannot be easily negated by policymakers really turns that commitment into one that is more durable and stable over a long time. What is also expected of climate laws is that they will help integrate climate change concerns into other policy areas, into energy policy, into agricultural policy, into food security. And importantly, it is also expected, as I mentioned, that they will keep the governments accountable for the objectives of meeting, for the objectives of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And now I'm pleased to let you know that yesterday, Grantham Research Institute at the London School of Economics has published a paper specifically looking at accountability around climate change laws. What are we seeing around the world? And what is necessary for climate laws to actually deliver? And what we find in that paper is that it's important for climate law to actually outline very specifically what is expected of governments and private actors, what is the substance of the obligation that is being created, who is accountable to whom, and especially how is compliance to be assessed, and what needs to be happen if the government or the private actor is deemed in non-compliance. When we look at the knowledge generated in the past years, we have learned quite a lot about the trends in climate legislation, about the key elements of climate law, but what we're still missing is the practical experience. So we still need more best practice information, knowledge exchange. And what we have here today is an excellent panel comprised both of practitioners, members of parliament, representing different types of economies, different regions. We also have scholars who have studied climate change laws who will here today share their knowledge on what is happening, what makes climate laws effective, and what are we still missing, what are the gaps. And it is my great pleasure to start this panel with Veselina Harlampieva, who is a senior counsel at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. And she is in charge of energy, and, which is in charge of energy and climate change in the Office of General Counsel's Legal Transition Team. She's an English solicitor and holds a Master of Law degree from Harvard Law School and Sophia University. And Veselina will be talking to us about the work that EBRD has been doing on climate laws in Southeastern Europe, Caucasus, and Central Asia and North Africa. Welcome, Veselina.
Many thanks, Alina. Thank you also to the Grantham Institute and to the University of Strathclyde for this invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. So I think maybe just to answer the question, why a representative from the Multilateral Development Bank is talking about legislation. So the last few days in the beginning of this week was really focused on the pledges of the updated pledges by the parties to the Paris Agreement, but also the updated pledges by the developed countries and the multilateral providers of climate finance in terms of the way, you know, they plan to scale up and accelerate delivery of and provision of climate finance. So in addition, what I think what we find at the EBRD of great kind of value to the emerging markets and developing countries where we operate is that in addition to our investment hand, in addition to us providing climate finance, we need to focus on capacity building and on policy reform, on legislative reform, in order to unlock these opportunities for investment. And all the public sector funding in the world is not enough to deliver on the Paris Agreement goals, as we have heard. The other big theme that came across is mobilization of private sector finance. So how do we mobilize private sector finance in the critical sectors of the economy, as Lina mentioned, in the energy systems, in agriculture, in transport? And I think that's where the policy pledges, the national determined contributions of the member state, of the parties of the Paris Agreement, identify the commitments, the targets, the sectors. But it's the legal frameworks, the regulatory frameworks, the governance institutions that create these binding obligations to the private and the public sector in the particular areas. So I just wanted to give you a couple of areas of engagement, and it's really very tempting to look outside at the march. So California, it's good to see so many people mobilized in this movement. So the first example in terms of mitigation action. So since 2012, I think the bank, it was 2012, the bank together with other partners developed guidelines for policymakers to incentivize private sector investment in the renewable energy sector. So what this really entailed in creating sector-specific targets and also policy instruments and, you know, institutions that will allow for competitive procurement and competitive tendering for renewable energy development. So what this led, so this unlocked, especially, you know, we engaged in countries that in our regions that are very carbon intensive, such as, you know, the Western Balkans, Egypt, Uzbekistan and others. But you know, working on setting the sector-specific regulatory framework in place, the relevant institutional the relevant institutional authorities that will be in place to basically de-risk the investment from the private sector, and without any incentives, because, you know, that nowadays we all know that the renewable energy in many countries have reached parity with conventional energy, but we're talking about, you know, 5-6 years ago. So this type of, you know, clear signals to the investors, allowing most effective price signals, but also with the the larger benefits to the community were embodied in these first kind of competitive legislative tenders. So we reached competitive prices in Egypt, including in Uzbekistan. This a few months ago was published, the tender, and the renewable energy developers, private sector developers, reached the cheapest price for renewable energy in the region, 2.5 cents per kilowatt hour. Other areas and another type of work I just wanted to identify is also by getting into areas that are very highly dependent. A new area for us is focusing on just transition. So ensuring that the transition, especially in the coal dependent regions, is fair and, you know, provides opportunities for the ones that are the most affected by this climate transition. So the communities there, and this also requires work with the regulators, work on you know, providing legal frameworks, institutional capacity building and opportunities. And just to wrap up, we, because we are a bank that works with public funds, but we mainly invest in the private sector, we really focus on other you know, kind of areas such as, you know, energy efficiency, that are more attractive for the private sector investor. And we look forward to working closer with national states on enabling such type of private public partnerships in, you know, the adaptation sectors, and these are the ones that require more dedicated, I think, legislative you know, approach and price signals.
So based on your experience so far, what would you say are the key lessons learned on how to help governments and also parliaments adopt more ambitious climate policies?
Thank you. So I think what we have noticed in our engagement with national authorities is quite frequently there is not much cooperation between various policymakers, various ministries, for example, in adaptation we are talking and environment. There is usually a lack of national plans or climate change legislation, kind of an umbrella legislation, to provide the necessary institutional framework, to provide this coordination between the various policy hands, policy you know, agencies of the government. And this has been a major obstacle, I think, because in a way, usually energy is a sector that's one front moving, and the ones otherwise transport, environment are not that close, how to say, to the Ministry of Finance. In many instances, there is a discussion that needs to take place and needs to be, you know, open to provide for clear, you know, short-term and mid-term plans, and to provide some incentives also for the private sector in order to develop public-private sector frameworks and projects with member states. The other quick point that I wanted to mention is we're talking a lot about, you know, national frameworks and about the role of the policymakers. But what we also are focusing on, I think it's important for development of legislative framework, is what is the role of the private sector in terms of developing climate actions, climate transition pathways and action plans. And disclosing their impact on the environment, their commitment to you know, switching to more sustainable, greener and resilient business models. And I think that this is also an area that has to be further looked at, and it's something that we will be pursuing, focusing on climate governance and climate disclosure and company law. So, because this is a fight that we all are in, from you know, MDB side, but on the public side, with a clear commitment also from the private actors to be transparent about their role in this major transition.
Thank you so much, Vesi.
Thank you, Lina. It's a pleasure.
Thank you. We will hear more from Vesi in the discussion segment. I'd like to invite our online participants to already start asking questions in the chat function and the Q&A function as we go along. But our next speaker is from South Korea. We're going to learn about experience of a country which is not featured so far much in the discussions on climate legislation. So it is my great pleasure to invite Member of Parliament, Ms. Sayong Lee, who is a lawyer and one of the youngest members of the National Assembly of the Republic of Korea. She is a former youth activist, so I'm sure you're very excited about what is happening in Glasgow at the moment. She left her career as a private in the private sector as a lawyer to actually form an NGO and become an activist in climate change. And she's been behind pushing for Green Deal in South Korea and also tabled the National Carbon Neutrality Bill together with a number of other members of parliament. So Ms. Lee, you're very welcome, and would like to learn, first of all, what was the key motivation, please, Jeremy, what was the motivation for the new climate neutrality bill, and what are its climate key features?
Thank you, Alina. Okay, this setting is quite strange to me. As she introduced me, my name is Hoyoung Lee. I'm serving as a member of the National Assembly of South Korea. Thank you for inviting me to this wonderful seminar. Today, I'd like to talk about the dramatic change that took place in Korea since I joined the National Assembly, Korea. Since my term began in June last year, the Korean National Assembly passed the 2050 carbon neutrality resolution in August, and the President Moon officially adopted 2050 carbon neutrality as Korea's long-term target. And earlier this year, the Carbon Neutrality Act, the full title is Framework Act on Carbon Neutrality and Green Growth for Climate Crisis. That bill, which I proposed, is passed, setting the legal framework for achieving net zero by 2050. This law is the topic I'd like to share with you today. For the first question, key motivation. Establishing a legal framework for a climate crisis was the mission I set for myself in the National Assembly. That mission was the key motivation personally. So immediately after the net zero announcement last year, I began preparing the proposal for the act. I believe that act should be a framework act and should include setting the principles, organizational structure, and budget for the next 30 years until 2050. So I wanted to talk about some key features of the law, control tower, fund, and implementation review process. I suggested a strong control tower because it is a long-term project. Traditionally, Ministry of Environment was in charge of the climate crisis, but they were often overpowered by Ministry of Energy or Ministry of Transport. So the new law established the Committee for Carbon Neutrality. That committee reports directly to the president and gives them authority to review and approve climate-related policies and plans across the ministries. Second is fund. The law sets the climate crisis fund. We need stable source of funding in order to implement climate policies. The National Assembly is currently working on the budget, and it will start with couple billion dollars per year, but we need to expand it. Third point is implementation scrutiny system. Then we need to make sure everything works. Korea has continuously failed to meet its target in the past. And we don't want to repeat this mistake. Thus, the committee will oversee the implementation of the reduction target every year and sector by sector. The last point, the law includes other duties like dedicated person for carbon neutrality will be designated among high-level officers in all major branches of the government and the sub-national government to make sure reduction targets are properly achieved.
Thank you so much. You raised really important points, which I think also, you know, how the climate bill, among other issues, is trying to improve coordination and empower ministries to address climate change, but also provided a very specific example on how climate law could help actually raise money, similar to what some of the points Veselina highlighted in her presentation as important challenges. So for you, what I would like to know is, what were the political dynamics leading up to the adoption of the law? We often hear countries struggle with getting support for climate legislation. And also from your personal perspective as youth activist, you know, seeing also a lot of young people marching today, what would you say was the role of young activists in this process? And what would you say to young activists around the world trying to make a case for climate policy?
Yeah, regarding political dynamics of this law, in Korea, fortunately, climate change itself is not controversial issue. So there was bipartisan support for a stronger climate legislation. However, getting into the details was not easy. We faced an unexpected obstacle, actually. The most progressive party in Korea, the Justice Party, argued that the law must specifically set the percentage of the 2030 reduction target. And then the debate on the law became a debate on the 2030 target. So it delayed the legislative process because the Conservative Party refused to agree on a long, strong NDC. My position was that the law does not have to specify the 2030 target, but instead leave room for future enhancement. Finally, we agreed to set the minimum in the law as 35% reduction from 2018. And later, the actual NDC was set by the government at 40%. And regarding youth activism, I always appreciate for their contribution. And young activists played a very important role, especially in Korea, until 3 or 4 years ago. The environmental groups in Korea has focused more on nuclear issue or nature conservation issues. Climate change became a central issue within the civil society in Korea because Youth for Climate Action, an amazing group for young adults, they led successful campaigns and school strike in Korea. And that was really the starting point of all the change that happened in Korea in the past few years. So I just want to say to young people's voices are being heard, and it is making real changes.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Thank you. So So our next speaker is a member of parliament as well, Ms. Agnes Mulder. She is a Dutch politician, and she is serving as the member of House of Representatives for the past decade, so even almost. And she represents the Christian Democratic Party, and she's also the member of the Sustainable Development Bureau of Interparliamentary Union, an international organization that unites parliaments around the world. So, Ms. Mulder, you're very welcome today. So, the Netherlands has adopted a Climate Change Act 2019. So, we were wondering what are the key features of this law. And also, another important piece of legislation that was passed is the law prohibiting coal in the Netherlands. So, we're really interested to learn, you know, what are the key features of those two pieces of legislation and how did they come about?
Well, thank you for having me here, and I'm really proud of meeting all of you and hearing from you and learning from you, I hope, because we cannot do this alone. That's why I'm a member of the Interparliamentary Union. This is an organization which really helps parliamentarians throughout the world if they are in trouble in human relations, maybe rule of law and other subjects, and also on climate change, we try to make a difference for one another. And I think it's really important to stand next to one another and to show the world that we are united on certain themes. And this is one of the themes where we are united on, and also in our parliament. But it it took this is never an easy road, of course, to change things for the better for our climate. And we, as parliamentarians, we created a law ourselves. You can always ask, of course, your government to create a law, and you can initiate your own law. So that's what, first of all, members of the opposition parties initiated. And I'm really proud of them that they did that. And then the coalition parties, we joined, and eventually we came up with this law. And that's a majority of 2/3 in our parliament that say long-term goals are really important for the Netherlands. And we wanted to do this also to get a European law, because the Netherlands is only a small country, as you all know, and we never can do things on our own. So we need a level playing field for our companies. And I read some of the things you just said about jobs, which are important to create new jobs, but also to maintain jobs in certain sectors while they change and create new jobs, for instance, in the steel industry. Nowadays, we have a terrific group of co-workers from Tata Steel, and they presented their own hydrogen change program for the steel factory in the Netherlands. And I think it's really great when the people who work at the companies also initiate the change, and we need the change in the whole of society, not only in parliament, but throughout the different sectors. And we have so many sectors: industry, agriculture, mobility, the energy, electric sectors, but also our buildings. Are they well enough? So we said with this climate law, we need to give direction towards 2050 so that we create a good atmosphere for companies to invest. Because if you don't know the direction, then it's really difficult to make the investments. And we need the investments from the companies really hard. So that's also why we need to have a European climate law. And the European Union came with a Fit for 55. And I'm a rapporteur for my parliament on this subject, also for a climate law in Europe. So, of course, there are always people saying, I think this climate law is totally worthless. We don't need it because there isn't really a problem. We have those parties in the Netherlands as well. So they are on this side. Then we have the broad majority of parties who say we want to make a change towards 2050. And of course, you have the parties who say it's not enough. For instance, in my parliament, some of the parties say 70% in 2030. So we now have 55 with a package from the European Union. In our law, it states 49% at least in 2030. But maybe we are going to make the goals more strict, but that depends. At the moment, we are negotiating. My party is one of the negotiating parties. And I can't tell you yet what the outcome will be. So this is what we needed to do. And it's a framework, just the goals. It doesn't state how we are going to realize these goals. This is something we need to do all together. So we have an outlook, a climate outlook. It's yearly, it's handed over from Parliament to our minister. So and they have to work on it. So they have to implement also everything that we should do to be able to achieve our goals. And it's a difficult path because we all have to pay for it. It's not a free lunch. So and sometimes people disagree and on the measures. And so you have to really discuss this in a fair and open and transparent way. Otherwise, we're not going to achieve our goals, and we really need to achieve them because we only have one planet Earth. So because we had a bit of a rough and difficult road, there was this Urgenda club, and they said, "Well, you're not doing enough, so we're going to sue you." So that's what they did. And they won because we said in all policy making, we said we are going to achieve this and that, and we weren't doing it. So now we really have to do it. And then if you have to do it, then you are going to see where can we reduce the tons. So the energy and electricity sector is one of the sectors where most needs to happen. And one of the most CO2 emitters are the coal plants we also have in the Netherlands. Basically, we had fairly new plants as well. So it was extra difficult to say, we're going to shut them down. And now we know really old plants in for instance, Poland, they're still there. And we're shutting down ours. And they're so much better or less worse. So what are we doing? So many people ask questions on this, and I think we should ask the questions, because we cannot reduce in the Netherlands and then the whole of the emissions are not going to be brought down in Europe. Then we have a real problem. So that's why we are really satisfied with the fact that we are going to do this with Europe, with all the countries. And then it's of course fair. Like was stated, we have to have a just transition. We cannot say, well, you are the losers and you are the winners. Good luck. That's not what we can do. We have to do this together. So I think that is a really important thing for us to do. And that's also why I'm so passionate about the Interparliamentarian Union, because we need each other. If we say well below 2 degrees, then all of the countries need to show that it's serious. Then you cannot say, hey, we're the South, we're the North, we don't have to do anything, because you will never get well below. If not everybody will join, we will never get well below. So of course, we as Western countries, we have to do our utmost to show the rest of the world that we are ambitious. And and I think we are ambitious. And that's something I really try to raise these goals the last couple of years, being a rapporteur for my parliament. And also, I spoke a lot with my parliamentarians from the European Parliament, because they are the ones also next to our national parliamentarians who can make the change. And of course, we really like that the European Commission is also straightforward and ambitious. And we need this, but we cannot do this alone. We're 8%. The European Union is 8% of the emissions. So we need all of you, and we need all of you to act together with us to have an honest level playing field for our companies, for our jobs, to get the right norms for us to produce our products worldwide. And please let us work together. I think that's
thank
my
you,
passionate that. Plea. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your passionate plea. And,
thank you, Ms. Muller, for sharing the experience from the Netherlands and especially for highlighting the links between climate change legislation and litigation as a way to provide accountability for the climate goals and also the importance of cooperating and being in it together and sharing practices. So our next speaker, we're going to change gears a little bit. So from talking about specific examples, national examples, we're now going to take a bit more global view. So our next speaker is Ellie Gold, who is a legal researcher at ClientEarth. And prior to which she worked for Amnesty International and Foreign and Commonwealth Office. And ClientEarth has published a report recently, which had quite alarming findings about the impacts and the impacts of climate change laws that we're seeing around the world. So Ellie, what are the key features that you've identified and key trends in terms of framework climate change laws around the world?
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I think the strongest and clearest trend that we've seen is just simply the proliferation of national framework laws that are ongoing at the moment. Since the UK's Climate Change Act came into law in 2008, we've seen so many other jurisdictions and even sub-national jurisdictions taking framework laws under their wing as part of their toolkit to transition to the net zero economy. And so as more and more jurisdictions are adopting these kind of laws, I think it's really important to get to grips with the pitfalls and the successes of where the existing laws have done things right and also where they've done things wrong. So that's the first trend. The second trend is sadly that unfortunately all of the six laws that we examined are falling short of what's required to transition those economies to net zero. It appears that whilst jurisdictions with national laws tend to reduce their emissions at a faster pace, it's still not enough to enact the deep changes at scale that we require. But it's not all doom and gloom. Our analysis shows that those national laws that can capture cross-party support or a kind of starting political consensus tend to do much better. So, for example, they operationalize quicker, they're fully implemented as opposed to other national frameworks. And it also means that if they begin with cross-party support, then of course they're more likely to survive apathetic or less motivated future administrations when they come into to play. I think one of the really good examples here is comparing the UK Act and the Victorian State of Australia's Act. So the UK Climate Change Act of 2008 had a lot of cross-party support. There was a lot of consensus around what the Act was going to look like and what was going to happen. And we know that the UK's Climate Change Act is one of the most successful out there. On the flip side, in Victoria, Australia, the law there and it has been deeply divided across partisan lines. And what this means is the Victorian Act, by contrast, is less operationalized. It's not fully implemented and it isn't having the same kind of traction that we'd like to see certainly in a framework law. I think something else that's really important to mention is the fact that these laws have a really important symbolism. So when we see that, when we see jurisdictions that enact national legislation, we can see that generally speaking, there's, as I say, a greater consensus. And four out of the six of the laws that we examined also created, established a independent scientific body. And this is really important as well. It's an example of not only the symbolic power of the very existence of a national law, but also how these laws can introduce political neutrality and symbolic power in and of themselves. So with these independent scientific bodies, such as the UK's Climate Change Committee, these are so important to providing a credible, independent, and put pressure on governments to take action on climate that isn't so politicized.
Thank you, Ellie. So based on your analysis, what would be your key recommendations to policymakers and legislators around the world?
So I think there are two key two key recommendations that we at Client Earth would make. I think it's really important to say that the existing framework laws that are in place really do set the ambition. And we're expecting to see a second generation of national climate laws come into play over the next decade. So as I say, it's really important to learn what we can from the existing laws that are in operation. The first recommendation is the lack of interim binding targets. So a lot of the laws that we examined, they will have a 2050 net zero target, which is enshrined in law. That's great. That's a really positive thing. But what we'd like to see is things like the 2030 milestone become into law as well. I think that's one of the only ways that we can ensure that not only we're on track to reach the 2050 target, but also that government is legally responsible and accountable to when that progress is off track. And I think, you know, we see this in Sweden. They have a 2045 net zero target that's enshrined in law, but the 2030 target is framed in precatory language. And again, in Victoria as well, not to call them out, they have a responsibility for a minister to set interim goals, but there is no corresponding responsibility to make sure that those interim targets match the pledges made by separate departments. So in theory, you could have a minister pledging an emissions reduction that is completely off base when it comes to those interim milestones. So that would be our first major recommendation. And just taking it back to the UK quickly, what we'd really like to see is an emissions reduction plan focusing on 2030 enshrined into law over the next couple of years. We think if the UK wishes to consolidate and extend its climate leadership, this is the best way for the UK to do that. And our second recommendation comes from our analysis, which found that there really are challenges, significant challenges that result when duties are imposed on the wrong arm of government, or simply areas of government that are not sufficiently equipped to enact these cross-sectoral, wide-sweeping societal changes that we need to hit net zero. So, for example, again in Sweden, the responsibility to meet the emissions reduction targets is full squarely on the Ministry of the Environment. And historically speaking, environmental ministries do not have the sufficient power, whether that's due to authority or due to just pure budgetary reasons. To, as I say, affect those sweeping changes that we need to see. And similarly, in Mexico and France, where duties are heavily siloed between the departments, we also see that this is overly prescriptive and it stifles organic cooperation. And so the best way around this really is to situate responsibility where it hits hardest, and that would be with the Prime Minister, Cabinet, and also the Treasury. It's really important that we align the projects that we're investing in as a country with the funds that are actually being allocated by the national treasuries. And this all kind of pulls together a larger point about enforcement. You know, how do we make sure that when progress on emissions slips, how do we make sure that accountability is in government? And I think that is answered not only by framework laws and the duties that they impose, but also by a robust civil society. And also there has to be an avenue within that legislation for domestic lawyers to challenge lack of progress. I think that's also really important. And that's where climate litigation comes in as a really instrumental force for progress. And I just wanted to leave on the note that we've seen over the COVID pandemic, governments are capable of stepping up, and they are capable of making big, potentially painful changes. I would like to know why that isn't necessarily the case on climate change too. Thank you.
Thank you, Ali. Thank you for this really useful messages on what we are seeing happening around the world, but also for reminding us that when there is political will, it can actually happen. So our next speaker is Dr. Tom Mincer. He received PhD at the Queen's University Belfast and currently is a senior lecturer in the Energy Transition Law Department at the University of Aberdeen Law School. He's worked extensively, in particular, on the UK Climate Change Act and is currently very involved in the climate discussions in Northern Ireland and also doing work on the European climate law. And he's co-edited a book which looked at several landmark climate change acts. So, Tom, you're very welcome. And what I'm interested to learn from you is, having analyzed those landmark climate change acts in the book, what trends have you noticed in terms of legal innovations that we're seeing across the climate change acts? And have you seen any difference in terms of newer climate change acts and the earlier climate change acts? We've mentioned UK quite a lot. So are we seeing any changes over time?
Yeah, thanks. It's lovely to be here with you all, and I've really enjoyed the contribution so far. I'm quite tall, so I'm a bit challenging for the for your camera here. I wonder how we are there. You missed the top of me, but yeah, well, I think an interesting starting point in terms of the question you put is, we're prompted to think about framework climate change laws by what Alina asks, and that's quite interesting. Eloise Scotford and Stephen Minas, two kind of distinguished lawyers and legal commentators, have pointed out that if you really think about it, in a sense, most laws can be climate change laws. If you think about economy-wide transitions, think about the laws that can impact that. Planning laws are relevant, could be building laws, maybe insulation of housing could be an issue and so forth. So climate law in some sense can almost be law in general. But when we think about framework climate change laws that Alina points to, there is a relatively specific meaning that has emerged in terms of the legal community's thinking around that. We're thinking about typically national framework climate change legislation, or what we might call climate change acts. That wasn't always entirely the case. There's a good quotation, I think, from Einstein, where he said once, if I set out to solve a problem in an hour, I spend the first 55 minutes thinking about what question to ask. It's maybe a little bit of a long lead-in time, but often initially when the research community and the legal community were thinking about climate change acts, we were sometimes talking past each other a little, talking about policy or executive orders, sometimes talking about legislation. And a kind of breakthrough with interpreting and understanding these acts, I think, came via Sarah Nash and Reinhard Sturer in 2019, where they quite simply, in their paper, Taking Stock of Climate Change Acts in Europe, defined what they meant very specifically by climate change acts. This is what we mean by a national climate framework. And that allowed them to flesh out what exactly they were looking at, what exactly we were concerned with. And when it came to putting the book together that Alina mentions, which is National Climate Change Acts, the Emergence, Form and Nature of National Climate Legislation, I sort of encountered a very similar problem to what had persisted initially when I was dealing with Alina, who was a contributor, and Andrew Jackson in Ireland, Asa Romson in Sweden, myself. I realized that sometimes we meant slightly different things by national climate change acts. So we really took Sarah and Reinhard's definition and tried to hammer it into something very concrete to articulate exactly what we mean. The definition that we came up with, we had to develop. I felt Sarah's definition a little, which was very good, but we're talking about framework legislation adopted by, reduced to its minimum logical foundations. This form of legislation should be taken to indicate a broad national legislative framework that has been set in place by a state legislature as an act of parliament or equivalent for the purpose of redressing specific problems posed by climate change in an overarching or otherwise broadly strategic manner within that particular country. So that definition has helped to stop us talking past each other a little. If we don't use that definition, the thing to do, I strongly suggest, is define exactly what you mean by a climate change act if you're producing a study. Ellie did that in her study, didn't use our definition, which is fine, but you did, you know, provide a decent definition of what you were actually talking about, which I think we need to do at this stage so we have a common rhetorical device. So if we look at what has been defined there, then we have a common description. We have work and thinking that's emerged in observation from kind of a range of parties. In the book that Alina mentioned, we were doing deep dives into some of the major climate frameworks, trying to piece together what the major components were, how they were playing out in practice. We were looking at Mexico. Alina led on that very, very well. We were looking at the UK. Richard McCrory was leading on that. We were looking at Ireland, which has a substantial climate act, New Zealand, which was doing interesting things. And we were also in a few other places building in conceptual chapters that tried to draw overarching lessons, what concepts emerge, what components seem to be ideal, similar to the work client Earth have been developing in the paper that they just published. They built in, I think, Finland as well, France, and a sub-state framework that was mentioned, the Climate Act in Victoria. When you roll all that together, we're looking at something very specific, a very specific type of legislation. We've got evidence we can draw on, and we've other good work too from Ecologic in particular, is a very good report on climate laws in Europe, which really delves into, it doesn't just describe the laws that exist, it tries to isolate key components within climate change acts within European countries and set them out for us and suggest that this seems to be a key component, that seems to be a key component. So sum all that up, we can identify a set of components that will likely appear in an optimum climate change act, although of course you need to make those components specific to national circumstances, so some national circumstances may require adjustment. So two major thematic components predominate: substantial focus on mitigation and a substantial focus on adaptation in an ideal climate framework. Might seem obvious, but we've gone through the mill with really overlooking or ignoring at times adaptation. And if you look at the first real extensive book on EU climate law, which came out in 2012, an Edward Elgar publication by Margin Peters, Mark Stallworthy, and Delaragon, they edited the book. They kind of use mitigation acts as a shorthand for climate change laws. And you can see how you would easily do that back then. But now we're very, very aware that adaptation must be a key component. Yes, sure. And in terms of granular components then that fall within these themes, we're thinking about targets, emissions reduction targets, carbon budgets, long-term planning procedures, the creation of an independent climate committee or equivalent independent advisory and reporting body, the adoption of robust mitigation and adaptation plans, public participation and engagement components, monitoring and reporting procedures, sanctioning mechanisms, and institutional transparency. And you can have a broad conversation about how one might flesh those components out, but we can look in extant acts to see how that's occurring. And the general, just to close here, the general assumption is that there is, if a state is constructing a climate change act along the definition that's been provided, there's an assumption that those components would feature in an optimally designed act, unless a burden to rebut that can be discharged. Maybe perhaps carbon budgets aren't relevant or necessary because they're in some other item of law or something like that. So there's the burden there. So that's the sort of sense of the general piece, Delina.
Great, thanks so much, Tom, for outlining the key aspects of the Climate Change Act. So perhaps very quickly, what could you say about, you know, the previous speakers have outlined the challenge of coming from the overall goal in the frame of climate legislation to specific policies. So from your analysis, what can you say about the relationship between national framework laws and the specific mitigation and adaptation measures and policies?
Yeah, that's another great question. I just again, maybe take this in a quick general point of broad principle. In a working life, as an academic, you have to teach, of course. And when you're trying to convey these acts to students, as you want to do often in a lively way, I tend to conceptualize them as skeleton regimes. And you, in essence, with a skeleton, we have a bone structure, don't we? We have a spine and we have bones. These climate change acts are typically framework acts. So they're rather like a skeleton. You have the skeletal structure, but a separate question often is, what will the flesh look like that's put on the, what will the flesh look like that we're going to put on the bones? And often that flesh will play out in the policy sphere. So an act like the UK Act sketches out a carbon budget regime, targets, sets up adaptation procedures in terms of reporting and risk assessment, does a range of things. The flesh and the bones, the policy in the sphere of mitigation and adaptation is somewhat left to play out in the political sphere. So when you ask Alina about the relationship between the framework acts and the specific mitigation and adaptation policies that emerge, there tends to be something of a hinterland between the act and the actual policies. So the act is a strategic direction setter, typically. It's a driver. It has targets, often carbon budgets and so on. It establishes procedures. The actual policies will typically play out, or often play out, more in the political sphere than within the direct parameters of the act. Just very briefly, the way it works with adaptation, let's take adaptation in the UK because we often overlook it. Climate Change Act in Part 4 does a couple of simple things. It says within 3 years of the act being passed, we must do a substantial risk assessment in the UK, Secretary of State's responsible. That occurred within the 3 years. And then in 2013, you had an adaptation program that responded to the risk assessment and set out policy options to deal with adaptation here and now and in terms of projected risks. Then we have another risk assessment will appear, another adaptation program. So you have that process. So that's what's happening. The flesh and the bones in the adaptation program is not determined within the concrete act itself. It's sketching out a procedure. That's the sort of thing I'm getting at when we think about that, Elena.
Thank you, Tom. So effectively, what you're saying is, as long as the Climate Change Act actually delegates clear responsibility to the government, outlines the timeline, and is very clear on what needs to happen, that's already a pretty good instrument. Thank you so much, Tom. I'd like to remind our online audience that we will be going into the question and answer session in just a few minutes. But now I'd like to invite my great pleasure to invite our last speaker, who is a discussant for this session. It's Ted Moyer. He's Oxford Martin Fellow and researcher at the Environmental Change Institute at the University of Oxford. He's a qualified lawyer, academic, and a consultant in energy, environment, and climate change. And Ted, among other things, has worked on climate change legislation in Africa, in particular in Kenya, but also globally. So Ted, please, you have the floor. No specific question, Ted is going to react to what we've heard so far.
One of these. Entirely my fault. Ladies and gentlemen, I have three tasks today. The first one is to paint a common picture of what our distinguished panel have spoken about today, which is probably the hardest of my three tasks. The second thing is for me to just highlight what I think is the importance of legislation for climate laws. And the third thing is to give a perspective from a developing country, and in this case, Kenya. So I'll start with the first one. And Vasilina, when Vasilina spoke, I was quite impressed because we've had meetings with Vasilina online, and it's been a long-standing joke that we know each other only from neck up. So it was quite wonderful for the first time to see her in the flesh. So Vesi gave two highlights. She said more things, but two highlights. The first thing is that national legislation somehow coordinates disjointed government bodies. So that was one of the main points that she highlighted. The second one was that national laws are key for the energy transition and specifically for private actors to have certainty about what is required of them. The next speaker, who was Soo-Yong Lee, spoke about an implementation review process. So one of the importance of climate laws is that it moves countries from targets into an implementation sort of mechanism, which, as we know, we are in COP right now. There is no implementation mechanism at multilateral level. So the second thing that she said that I thought was quite interesting was that the law sets minimum standards over which, over the next few years, are supposed to then be improved upwards. And this has led to youth activism in South Korea. And then we had Agnes Moller from the Netherlands, and she said, in fact, I thought she'd looked at some of my notes before she started speaking, because she said three things that will be in the next session that I'm going to speak about. The first one is that climate law gives direction. And the second thing was that, and this was the mention of the Uganda case, which I never knew how it was pronounced until I arrived in the Netherlands, because I thought it was their gender case until someone said Uganda, and I thought, and when the slide came up, I was pleasantly surprised. But we also need to link this session with the other sessions that are going on. And so one of the things that climate laws do is that then they create what we call justiciable principles, rights and obligations that people can take to court that can lead to action. Now, in the Netherlands, when the Uganda case, it seems like it was the converse. When that case created certain obligations for private parties, it seems now to spur negotiations on what legislation can do. Ellie mentioned several things, two of which were wonderful. The first one was that there are interim binding targets. We know from COP, we do not have legally binding agreements. And what laws do is that they crystallize, they codify all these targets into binding national targets. The second thing that she said that I thought was extremely important was it then allows lawyers to challenge lack of action in governments. And she asked one question. We know because of COVID there has been rapid action. Why haven't we seen the same thing for climate? For our online audience, if you looked at this room, it looks like a very serious and polite and fancy dress party. Everybody has different colored masks on, and this is our new reality. What COVID has told us is that it is possible on an international level to make very serious, not only cultural changes, but behavioral changes for the common good. Finally, Thomas mentioned two things. Number one, the importance of definition. We need to speak the same language. We need to create a common understanding of what the problem is, and this is what legislation does. And two, it's the bones, he said. Climate change laws create the foundation for policy, change, and action. So I have, I think, about 2 minutes before we go to the question and answer. And I have this to say about Kenya and about why I think climate change laws are important. Number one, it changes from an aims and principles and targets dynamic into a rights and duties dynamic, where then now courts are empowered to make judgments based on laws. Number two, it broadens inclusion, and actors who do not have a seat at multilateral level, whether you talk about communities and private companies and smaller players, are then given the space to challenge governments and lead to action. Number three, it changes the political dynamic. I forget who on the panel mentioned this, but they're symbolic. I think it was Ellie. She said there's a certain level of symbolism that climate change acts do that then spurs political action. The other thing is economics. It creates certainty. Where there's uncertainty, private actors then do what they suits them for profit. So certainty is wonderful. Now, on from a developing country perspective, we have seen a real change in Kenya in its climate change law from 2016. And I'll highlight only 4 points. Number one, it's changed national planning on climate because a specific body has been created for it and there's a national climate change action plan. Number two, it has broadened the constitutional foundations. The right to a healthy environment is now in that act. Number three, it has created a national registry for mitigation for public bodies. Number four, it has recognized vulnerable groups, and it has created science-based solutions. But, and this is interesting from a developing country perspective, it's taken into account indigenous knowledge in dealing with climate change. And this is quite unique. And finally, it has dealt with climate finance, because nothing can be done without putting our money where our mouths are. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Ted, for this amazing summary of today's discussion, and also for bringing up some additional points which haven't quite yet been touched, in particular on inclusion and participation. So thank you so much for that. So we're going to go into a question and answer session now. Before I go to our in-person audience, I'm going to take some of the questions from our online followers. So there is a live connection from COP26 currently in Glasgow. So Destination Cross River State was the first British protectorate during the only remaining virgin tropical mangrove rainforest catchment area. Okay, so I think that's not a question, that's a comment. Okay, so I think someone is asking about collective participation and okay, so both of the questions, these are not questions, these are all comments. So let's go to the in-person audience. So who has a question to the panelists? Please, would you introduce yourself? And if you don't mind coming closer to the mic, that would be amazing.
Sure.
Hello, I'm Marcus Davies. Hi, I work for Climate Policy Radar. We're a nonprofit startup using machine learning and artificial intelligence to map global climate policies. I had a question for Ellie, a client at Earth. It was really interesting listening to Client Earth's analysis of different national climate laws. And you mentioned a few different criteria that you use to assess the efficacy of national climate laws. I think you mentioned cross-party support, creation of a scientific body, for example. And I was just wondering, besides those criteria, whether it would just basically be interested to hear a little bit more about your methodology. I realize I could probably just read the paper, it was a sort of general question about whether you had a kind of systematic approach to analyzing national climate laws, or whether it was sort of slightly more informal, slightly more anecdotal. Because it's definitely an interesting idea, having a systematic kind of approach to evaluating national climate laws, especially given, as you said, the kind of rapidly increasing number of national climate laws that we're seeing globally.
Great, thanks, Matthew. Any other questions at this point? Kate, please.
Hi, so thank you, everybody, and thank you so much. I just have to say this, for bearing with us while we sort out the challenges of hybrid events. I hope our online audience can hear, and I'm sorry for various technical hiccups. But I have a question sort of based on something that Ms. Lee said, which was about, you know, the sort of importance of creating a framework where the right institutions and the right ministries and, you know, the right actors have access to decision makers at the right level to get things done. And I wondered if maybe sort of anyone on the panel could sort of speak to your experience with that and the need for this kind of coordination and ensuring that climate is elevated from an issue, you know, that we see maybe only in some ministries with limited power to a central issue that everyone across government is thinking about, and the role of legislation in that. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm afraid we will have to, for logistical challenges, have to come up to the microphone again to answer questions, but thank you for bearing with us. So the first question, I think more broadly on the methodology, how can we compare and analyze different framework laws?
Thank you. Thank you, Marcus, for your question. In short, it's quite difficult. The methodology that we came up with was intentionally quite limited. So we wanted to look at laws that were specifically oriented towards climate mitigation, reducing emissions across the economy. So we looked at laws that interact with every single sector in a particular jurisdiction, and laws that have climate change at their heart. And when we first started conducting our research, it was quite difficult, as you know, you've highlighted, it's quite difficult to sort of package these laws into a specific box, because every jurisdiction is different, every sector is different, the challenges are very different as well. So I think for us, we just wanted to look at laws that were in existence, that had been in existence for a certain amount of time, so we could look at the data and see, actually, are these laws reducing emissions as we'd hoped and as they had hoped. But as I say, laws that take an overarching approach to sectors and the economy. I'm not sure whether we would use that methodology today, because new laws have come into place. And, you know, as we know, society and legal frameworks are constantly changing, and how we define these frameworks is really important. But I think when it comes to a criteria for success, in our report, we have six principles, but sort of the ones that are most important for me is, as I say, bind your interim targets, keep the legislation simple. It is a framework, not a prescriptive Bible, and have the responsibilities sit with the highest level of government, with the people that can actually make those changes. And I think those are the really key areas and the key criteria for a successful climate framework law.
Thank you, Ellie. So the next question was about coordination and how to make sure that different and the right bodies are actually working together. So Ms. Lee, would you like to take that? But if anyone else wants to add later on, please feel free.
Thank you for the question. Your question is quite difficult. I think to answer your question better, I'm going to ask my colleague to translate my response for
Mr. Yun, please. Coordination 어떻게 하느냐? 실제로 지금 이제 최근에 그 클라이밋 체인지와 탄소 중립이 너무 중요한 아젠다로 부각되면서 지금까지는 관심이 없었던 각각의 부처들이 이제 서로 그 권한을 가져가려고 다투고 있는데, 그 말씀하신 대로 누구에게 권한을, 적합한 권한을 부여하는지가 정말로 중요한 것 같습니다. 중간에 트랜슬레이 하실래요?
As the importance of climate change mitigation and then reaching carbon neutrality has become more and more important, ministries and branches that were traditionally rather indifferent to this issue is stepping forward to get even more authority and more engagement on this issue. So as you pointed out, distributing this issue to the right ministries is of great importance.
그 국가마다 상황이 좀 다르다고 생각되는데 한국의 경우에는 에너지를 담당하는 부처가 산업의 지능을 담당하는 부처랑 결합되어 있기 때문에 산업 통상 에너지 자원을 이제 한 부처에서 하고 있는데 이거 자체가 사실 롤이 컨플릭트가 있는 거여서 에너지 기후를 위해서 에너지를 규제하는 롤을 이제 산업을 지능하는 이런 부처에서 하는 것이 이제 모순된 상황이고 그렇기 때문에 그 에너지가 온실가스 배출에 거의 한 87%를 차지하는데도 불구하고 그걸 담당하는 부처는 계속해서 이제 기후 대응을 방해하고 이렇게 막아온 그런 히스토리가 있기 때문에 사실 이 탄소 중립 기본법에서도 어떤 특정한 부처에게 권한을 주는 것이 아니라 이런 부처들의 이해관계를 조정할 수 있는 이런 하이레벨 위원회를 두는 것이 중요하다고 생각을 한 것입니다.
The situation would be different country by country, of course, but for a Korean case, the Ministry of Industry, Trade and Energy is in charge of the energy issues and also promotion of industry. And there's an obvious conflict of role there because we need to change the energy sector in order to mitigate climate change. Especially in Korea, energy sector is responsible for almost 87% of the entire greenhouse gas emissions. So the approach we took in the Framework Act is to establish a higher echelon coordinating role, and that's what the Carbon Neutrality Committee is going to do. So instead of rearranging, we have a higher committee that makes the decision and coordinates the role between the ministries.
그런데 이제 문제는 그 하이레벨 위원회를 만드는 과정에서 기존의 Ministry of Energy, Ministry of Environment, Ministry of Land and Transport, every ministries 이거를 뺏기지 않으려고 했고 그래서 처음에는 별도의 조직과 예산을 가진 독립적인 위원회로 이걸 만들려고 했었는데 실제로는 그 부처들의 반대 때문에 이제 어떤 심의하는 그냥 회의체로 이 위원회를 발족하게 됐고 앞으로 이 위원회가 조금 더 이 부처들을 조정할 수 있는 실질적인 권한을 가질 수 있게 법을 디벨롭하는 게 과제라고 생각이 듭니다.
Of course, there was significant resistance from the ministries because they wanted to retain their original authority. So my original design was to actually have a completely independent committee that has a complete set of staffs and budget, but due to resistance from the ministries, the compromise had to be made, and the committee is currently has only the reviewing or approval authority. But this is something that we need to work on going forward, and I am planning to strengthen the independence and the power of the committee so the coordination role can be better.
Is this answer enough?
Yes, perfect. Thank you so much. Would any other panelists like to add on coordination at all?
I just make a quick comment on that because it's a really interesting issue. You know, how does one get everyone across government thinking about these issues, as you put it? And that's a hard question. There's really interesting work going on that point in New Zealand at the moment. and they're describing the issue as mainstreaming. If you look at Ellie's report, it makes brief mention of mainstreaming. Ecologic have mentioned it previously, that do important work on climate acts as well, but how do you mainstream it? And that's a difficult question, but it's been suggested within UK discussions that because we have a public sector equality duty, that might be a kind of template to help mainstream this. So that duty requires public bodies to have due regard to the need to eliminate discrimination, advance equality of opportunity, and foster good relations between different people when carrying out their activities. So that might be a sort of a type of template under the Equalities Act, you know, that might allow the sort of consciousness raising to persist that's required here. But just briefly as well, because we're talking about law, one thing that's interesting is how the duties are constructed often under these acts. If you look at the UK Act, so you're raising this theme of cross-governmental thinking and involvement, the UK Act places the net zero duty, which is at section 1.1 of that act, on the Secretary of State for BEIS, so it's Kwesi Kwarteng at the moment. So there's a particular governmental actor bears the duty to secure the target. If you look at the Scottish legislation, Scotland has quite a sophisticated sub-state climate change act, Climate Change Scotland Act 2009. It places that duty, the equivalent duty, which is a net zero target for 2045, on the Scottish ministers. It's a legal term, meaning the Scottish government. So it's kind of socialized across the government as a whole. It's not so much an innovation of the act. It's more how constitutional law in the UK tends to behave, because we're at the sub-state scale there. But you do have this question as well as to where duties will be placed. Would it be on the government as a whole or not? And just briefly, there's a really live wrangle going on in Northern Ireland, where I happen to be from at the moment, as to whether or not we've two climate bills in our parliament. Key reduction duties should be placed on government departments generally, we have a devolved government like Scotland, or on a particular minister. Or is there another way to couch it? But when it's socialized across ministers, it speaks to that theme of all departments having a buy-in as well. So just a really interesting question you raise, you know. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Okay, we have a question from online audience, so Kate is gonna ask that.
So this is a question that sort of asks about the medium and long-term impacts from all of what we've been hearing here today for the less developed world. To sort of paraphrase a little bit, and I hope the questioner will allow me that, you know, as I understand it, you know, there's a question here about what are we seeing in terms of legislation in the developing world, and also what are we seeing in terms of whether or not legislation in the global north or the developed world is doing the job that we need to address issues that we know are ultimately going to impose kind of impacts in the global south. So really interested in anyone's perspective on that. Thank you. And I hope our questioner will forgive my intervention.
Thanks, Kate. And if I may tag along to that question in terms of the North, legislation in the North, maybe to you, Ms. Malden, but any other panelists. We're discussing here the failure of industrialized countries to meet 100 billion target and mobilize climate finance to developing countries. Do you see the role in climate legislation also in terms of financial commitments that countries in the North have in respect to developing countries to help them implement climate change policies? So whoever wants to go first, you have the floor.
We recently had debates on this issue in our parliament because there was this United Nations meeting in September, and our minister was going there, and we asked him specifically, is our country delivering what we promised? And he said, yes, we are, and the figures could be given as well. And I think this is promising, but I think all of the countries should deliver. So fortunately now the United States is going to deliver again, but they didn't, of course, and they are a big player. So it's really important that they also deliver. And there are a couple of other countries who still have to provide enormous sums of money, because I think we're lacking 10% still, and 10% is too much. You cannot say we made an agreement and then not deliver. So we should be ashamed.
Thank you for that. Yeah, please.
Thank you. I'll come very quickly. So what I wanted, I mean, definitely, I think just speaking in support of what has been said, but slightly also to take a different perspective, because of course, climate finance is essential and it's important, and the developed countries need to meet their pledges in terms of supporting these changes taking place, not only in the global north, but also in the global south. But with the role of the legislation, I think, in the developing countries, and also not only legislative frameworks, but also I think the capacity building and this transfer of green technology needs to happen so that they are viable, credible projects, commercial projects that can actually absorb this type of financing. Because it's not only a numbers game, it's really about utilizing it and making a change, a scalable and replication of investments in new and green technology. I gave you the example of renewable energy because this is how it started. It was not a commercial area. It became, it's mature now because of the renewable and because of the frameworks, but also because of the private sector finance that came in with, you know, public sector finance to de-risk, to unlock. And this has to happen with other technology as well. The other topic I wanted quickly to touch upon is the financial flows we're discussing also from the global north to the global south, about multinational corporations with supply chains in all these regions, about financial, large financial institutions that now are pressed by the public, but also by policymakers in the UK, in New Zealand, and you know, financial regulations to account on the type of investments that they are making. Are they green? How sustainable they are? And I think this is also a role for the legislator, but also for, you know, the financial regulators to implement these requirements for the large asset managers to be, you know, accountable on the type of projects that they finance. How climate resilient they are, what are the climate related risks. And I think one of the great announcements earlier this week was the merge of the various standards and, you know, and frameworks such as the TCFD and SASB and IFRS foundations into this new International Sustainability Standards Board. The idea would be for all of us to know whether investments are green, right? So not just to paint them green by developers or by, you know, investors, but to have a clear criteria and standards that would help channel finance, international finance, into emerging markets, into really technologies and projects that are put the countries and the private sector, including the industrial, large industries, into a pathways to low carbon and resilient future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vesey and Ted.
I cannot see myself, but it's fine. I think the role of legislation in countries, both developed and developing, is fundamental in terms of moving us from a promises dynamic into an action dynamic. Because if we're talking about the 100 billion pledge per year, the OECD report of 17th of September 2021 showed that there was a 20 billion deficit. And then the aftermath of that report is that there were textual arguments as to whether this was supposed to be a 100 billion pledge or 100 billion per year. Had these things been in legislation, where every year there's in the national budget, there's a number in a developed country where this money is going, there would be greater accountability, one, in terms of ensuring that that finance is available, but two, the citizens of a country, a developed country, would want to see that if their taxes are going to a third country, that though that money is put into good use. And conversely, from a developing country perspective, if there were to be a legislation, the same obligation would be there. There would be an obligation to have certain monies set aside for climate, and not only to have certain monies set aside, but accountability mechanisms. So I think legislation moves us, makes COP more meaningful, because it moves us from these promises dynamic. Look, it's like what, you know, apparent was no intention of meeting their obligation. They come, countries come here, they're shamed into action, they give wild promises that they have no intention of keeping. But the last thing that I want to say about legislation is that it insulates countries and populations from regime change shocks, such that if there were to be a different president or prime minister, whether they like how things are or not, it's a far more intricate way of changing things, other than just coming to an international conference and saying, I'm not pledging, or sorry, I'm not turning up. So legislation is key in terms of spurring action. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. And I think that's an excellent note to end on this really rich discussion today, which really touched on different aspects on how to move from pledges to action and how legislation at the national level is absolutely central to that. So I'd like to thank all of our speakers today. Thank you so much. And also thank you for the online audience and those who were here in Glasgow with us today. So thank you.